Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most people have heard of or are familiar with the Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. It was a pivotal event in America's civil rights movement. This 382-day mass protest began on December the 5th, 1955, when today's guest was 4 years old. That was the first day black residents in Montgomery refused to ride city buses because of segregated seating laws. It made national news at the time and began because 4 days earlier, a woman named Rosa Parks had been arrested for refusing to give up her seat to a white passenger. The Montgomery bus boycott proved that coordinated, peaceful, collective action could dismantle Jim Crow policies. So, most people are aware of the boycott and its impact. They know of Rosa Parks, but they likely don't know about the man whose behind-the-scenes activities helped nurture and sustain the legal and community network that made the boycott possible. That man was Thomas Gray, a businessman and activist who eventually became a lawyer and a judge. And he was not the only member of his family whose civil rights activities resulted in a sea change. His younger brother, Fred Gray, became the lead civil rights attorney for the plaintiffs in the case before the U.S. Supreme Court that ended bus segregation. Well, now, Fred's niece, Thomas Gray's daughter, is telling her father's story. That's a difficult sentence. And award-winning journalist Karen Gray Houston has written Daughter of the Boycott, carrying on a Montgomery family's civil rights legacy. And Karen Gray Houston joins us now for the hour. Welcome.
Great being with you, Mike. I'm so glad you're interested in my story.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to have you here. We have a lot of things in common. You spent a lot of time in radio at the national level. You were a reporter in Washington for the Fox TV affiliate, a station for whose radio station I used to work. You were a correspondent, a White House correspondent during the Reagan years for NBC News. You worked as an anchor for the ABC radio network. You spent time at radio stations in D.C. and in Boston. But this is your first book.
It is.
And it's a family story, and it's a major story in the civil rights movement. What took you so long to write it? Too busy doing radio and television?
That's actually part of the problem. I did do that, and then, you know what? I didn't know a lot of the story until I was an adult. My father didn't really talk about it and harp on it, and neither did my uncle. They were out doing their own things. And when I retired, or before I retired, I was thinking, you know what? And so was my younger brother, Thomas Jr. Dad knows so much about what happened, and he didn't tell us as we were growing up. The family wove a little cocoon around us to protect us from all the ugliness of the segregation. And, you know, I met Rosa Parks as a young child, but I was too young and too dumb to ask questions about what was going on at the time. And so it really wasn't until I was an adult and thinking back, look at all these important things that happened. And I know there's more to the story.
Yeah,
I want to know the little known untold stories. And so that sort of catapulted me into thinking, maybe time to write a book. But you know what? My uncle had written a book, Fred Gray, renowned civil rights attorney, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. You know, he had written Bus Ride to Justice, which is about the boycott. It was about his illustrious career. My father started writing a book himself late in his life. He had retired from being a judge. My mom had Alzheimer's, and he was a caretaker. And then he died of cancer. And then I knew it was my turn to write.
You said that I was going to ask you, one of my questions was going to be, why didn't your father share a lot of these stories? But you just explained that he wanted to protect you from the ugliness. But you still grew up in a time. I remember these things. I remember, excuse the expression, colored water fountains, mm-hmm. colored restrooms. And I remember driving through the South, going to Florida to visit my grandfather and seeing things that I had never seen before because I grew up in the D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
So
still sort of the South, but yeah, not quite the same.
But you weren't oblivious to this as a child. So why wouldn't he talk about what were significant contributions?
You know what I think? I think it's akin to soldiers who came back from World War II and other wars, and they didn't pass along the horrors of war to their children, or Jewish people who survived the Holocaust and they came back home, they came back to America or whatever, and they didn't talk about the atrocities that they had experienced under Nazi Germany.
Was it not only a desire to protect the younger generation, but also a way to move on, to move past it?
They were living their lives. My dad was, you know, he had decided he wanted to become a lawyer. He wanted to be one early on, but he, you know, got distracted by my mother. They were college sweethearts at Alabama State University. And so he started, he had a business. He co-owned a radio and TV and appliance store where he, you know.
It's in your blood.
Well, let me tell you this one other thing. My father was one of the first black radio announcers in the state of Alabama. During the bus boycott, he had a side gig as a radio announcer, and he, a lot of people would wake up in the mornings, you know, they're frying up their bacon and eggs and listening to the radio. They wanted to find out where the mass meetings were going to be at the churches so they could find out from Reverend King what was going on, where they could get a ride to work without getting on the buses. So, interesting.
This book came out, I think, a couple of years ago, and it took you a while to write it because you did a lot of research. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just conversations with your father and your uncle. It was a lot of hard research, National Archives and places like that. But at the time you were doing that research, I understand, racial turmoil was in the news again. It was the summer of 2014. There had been the string of killings of unarmed black men by police that everybody knows about, and started the George Floyd marches, et cetera. We had Donald Trump running for president. We had Donald Trump being president. and the incident in Charlottesville where he said both sides were essentially equivalent to the white nationalists with the people who died, or the woman who died, which we all know is not true. You write that all of that combined to expose the hidden anxieties of many white people, making me wonder how deeply racism is still embedded in our society. Or were we simply coming back full circle? Do you have an answer to that question?
Well, are we coming back full circle? We're regressing. We're going back. We're going in reverse right now. My uncle, Fred Gray, says the same thing. He says maybe it's time for another civil rights movement, a second civil rights movement. I'm not sure where we go from here. I'm looking at books being banned. I'm nervous about my own book. I mean, more books have been banned in the last few years than probably in our memory. The books are being banned. There's efforts to erase this kind of history. There was an instance in Florida where a book company, a publisher, was going to change the way they were writing the Rosa Parks story. And they're going to tell the story without mentioning the factor of race, just that she was arrested because she refused an order to get up out of her seat. But with how do you tell that story without saying because she was a black person and she was asked to give up her seat to a white person? So there's that. There's in more recent days, what happened in Philadelphia with the president's mansion, you know, where the executive house, what did they call it, where President Washington, George Washington and Adams used to live. And there was an incredible exhibit about black enslaved people it's part of an outdoor exhibit at the museum. And all of a sudden it mysteriously disappeared. This happened very quietly, but people who knew the museum showed up and said, hey, what happened to that? And so finally, a federal judge ordered that they take, you know, after the exhibit was removed, that they had to replace it. So these are very alarming, disturbing things that are happening right now. And I don't know what direction we're going in and how we change some of this.
You know, when I think about some of the stupid Jim Crow rules that were in effect when your father was fighting them, the words that come to my mind are ridiculous and pathetic. Mm-hmm. And these efforts to stamp out American history, to me, are ridiculous and pathetic. But then there are books like yours that come out And they can stamp out all the history they want, but the history exists. And
you
the history.
You can't change the history.
Right.
You can try to remove it and take it, make it inaccessible to people, to children in libraries and, you know, that kind of thing. But here's the irony. Go to a bookstore, and I love going into a bookstore and seeing a big round table with banned books on it, you know, or books about racial justice and seeing my book there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not having a good effect. I mean, you can go and people are, you know, the books are still out there and some of them are still selling. But in libraries, and that's my concern, school libraries, last year, because of an executive order, books about race and gender identity, LGBTQ issues were removed from military school libraries around the world. And then a judge reversed that and said, you got to put them back. So, I mean, I have hope.
Good. You did extensive research for this book. You had lots of conversations with people. You did primary research by looking through tons, scads of documents and papers and letters. And your father left behind what you describe as a wealth of written material. In all the research you did, in all of the documents that you combed through, did you discover anything you didn't know about your father's participation, your uncle's participation, your mother's participation in this boycott movement in the 1950s?
I interviewed my father at the prodding of my younger brother, Thomas Jr., who said he knows so much, let's sit him down and just put a camera in from. My brother took a camcorder everywhere and shot everything, and he got on our last nerves. But then it was like, this makes some sense. Let's put Dad down there. And he started talking about 1950. You know, it's sort of like we all approached that whole issue, like starting in 1955 with, you know, Rosa Parks getting arrested and until we knew about little 15-year-old Claudette Colvin. But before we get to that, in 1950, a man named Hilliard Brooks was a World War II vet like my dad. He had been in the Navy like my dad. He had a young family at home, couple of kids, pregnant wife, trying to get a ride on a bus in downtown Montgomery. Admittedly, Hilliard was drunk and disorderly. It's unclear exactly what happened, but the bus driver called over a police officer to handle a disorderly conduct incident. And Hilliard was shot and killed. The police officer came, you know, Justice Department report said that the arriving police officer got on the bus and went over and hit Hilliard with a club. And as he was exiting the bus, shot Hilliard. Eyewitnesses, according to newspaper reports, said that he was on the sidewalk by then. And when the officer arrived, he pushed Hilliard to the ground. And as Hilliard was getting up, he shot. Whatever happened, there was no justification for shooting and killing a man. He was about 5'7", 160 pounds. No reason to kill him and act like, you know, like you're the judge, jury, and executioner. So that my dad was outraged about it, knew him, played street football with him as a kid, was teaching at a Catholic school where they were training veterans. Mm-hmm. And he and the commander, the AMVETS commander, said, hey, we got to do something about this. So they wrote a letter to city officials.
And that's the beginning of the boycott, which we'll talk about. That's what led ultimately to this movement, I suppose, is the best way to say it. We're talking to Karen Gray Houston, whose father, Thomas, is one of the leaders of this boycott movement, which we'll talk about when we come back. And her book is called The Daughter of the Boycott, Carrying on a Montgomery Family's Civil Rights Legacy. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Daughter of the Boycott. The daughter is here. Karen Gray Houston. That's the name of her book, and it's about her father. And a great deal of it is about her uncle, Fred, both of whom were pivotal in the Montgomery bus boycott of the mid-1950s, which is fading into memory, distant, misty memory. But that's why this book is important, because people need to know about that movement and what led to it and why it happened. Before we talk more about what led up to the boycott and the boycott itself, talk to me about your father. Thomas Gray. Who was he as a human being? Who was he?
Thomas Gray had a low tolerance for being mistreated. Put it that way. He was a really smart guy, valedictorian of his high school class. Met my mom at Alabama State Teachers College for Negroes, is what they called it at the time. He wanted to be a lawyer, but he got distracted, you know, got married, had three children at home, and we were all there when the boycott started. Didn't tell us as children, I was four, anything about what was going on. But what was interesting was we were going to nursery school at Holt Street Baptist Church, which is where they had the first big mass meeting where they decided that Martin Luther King was going to be the leader of the bus boycott. But during the day, they had nursery school and kindergarten, and that's where we were going to school. And I knew nothing about anything because I guess they wanted to protect us from all of...
Oh, you were also years old.
And I was four. You don't have a conversation with a kid about, you know, we're trying to get buses integrated.
So you were talking before the break about your father's friend who had been shot and killed for no particular reason, just because he was a black man on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama in 1950. Well, it's still happening today, clearly, but that was 1950. And that was 5 years before the bus boycott. But that kind of lit a fire, as you said, under your father.
Set the stage for the boycott later. But with my father, he was angry. And so he and the AMVETS commander, Ronald Young, wrote a letter to city officials, to the mayor, the police commissioner, city hall. You should prosecute this police officer, Officer M.E. Mills, to the fullest extent of the law. And Mike, what did they do? There was a judicial review board that said it was a justifiable shooting.
Of course.
So my dad and Ron Young said, oh, heck no, we're going to do something about it. We're going to have a big rally, a big protest. They had hundreds of veterans who marched on Main Street, Dexter Avenue, downtown, and they wrote signs. They had signs that said, ballots will beat bullets. And they knew that they couldn't just kind of hang around. They didn't want to get arrested for loitering. So they thought, and here will be a double-edged prong to this thing. We'll go down, and for the people who haven't registered to vote, and which many black people had not at the time, go into the courthouse where you could register, and they registered to vote. So the stories in the paper the next day said almost nothing about the rally and the protests, which lasted for several days. They did mention that it was very unusual. For some reason out of nowhere, hundreds of Negroes came in and registered to vote. So it was Dad's first kind of big pro-voting rights rally.
I mean, it's perfectly understandable that your father would be outraged by this murder on its own, but this was a friend of his, an acquaintance of his from high school that he knew well. So that's perfectly understandable. But please, let us go back. This is 76 years ago. This is 1950 in Montgomery, Alabama. People died.
Trying to get the right to vote.
Right. If they stepped out of line. If they looked the wrong way.
They got beaten down trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Your father was, what was he, 26 at the time?
Well, actually, he was a little older. He was about 31. My uncle was about 26. I think he had just fallen out of law school. And Martin Luther King was about 25. These were young guys.
Yeah. And your father was in business with another person running this store that you talked about, this electronics store. He had a wife. He had children. By getting involved, he had a lot
to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it was dangerous.
Yes. Where did the courage come from, I guess, is the question.
And built in, you know, encouraged by his mother. She raised five children without a husband. You know, he died when my Uncle Fred was 2 years old. He had pneumonia and died. And she struggled to raise those children, but she, you know, she encouraged them to all get a good education, told them to stay away from, you know, don't get in trouble, don't get involved in the criminal justice system. And, they, you know, it was just a lot of grit with those guys, with the kids.
But I know he's a personal friend. Hilliard Brooks was a personal friend of your father's, the man who died. But there were other heinous acts at the time. I think this was around the time of Emmett Till.
Yes.
So what was it about this moment in time? Did your father ever talk about this? What was it about this moment, this incident, that made him decide, I'm going to put it all on the line?
You know what? And I don't even know that I know the answer to that. But he had to uproot our family after the bus boycott because he wanted to be a lawyer. And black people were not admitted to law schools in the state of Alabama. He and say did the same thing that Fred Gray, my uncle, did, went to Cleveland, Ohio. But, you know, I called him Uncle Teddy. Uncle Teddy came back. He was on a mission. He was going to destroy everything segregated he could find. And then my dad wanted to go up, get his law degree, and come back and join him practicing law and desegregating everything that needed desegregating in the state of Alabama. Some kind of way he couldn't pass the bar in the state of Alabama after my uncle was so involved. And so he ended up having an entire career in civil rights law in Ohio, which, you know, racial discrimination didn't stop at the Mason-Dixon line.
Right, right.
So he practiced civil rights law, fair housing law, that kind of poverty law, and eventually and ironically had a federal appointment to a position as a judge in the state of Alabama, and he and my mother returned there later in his life.
Young people today either don't know about this or don't really understand it because they can't quite fathom what the world was like in 1950 or 1955. They just can't get it.
Want me to draw you a picture?
Please. That was gonna be my question. Put this into perspective for today's young person.
Everything was segregated. It was the law. Jim Crow law did not allow black people to attend white schools, go to white restaurants, stay in white hotels, use white bathrooms. I mean, water fountains were set aside for white people only. So black people were seething with anger about their day-to-day lives.
And not only was it just the schools that were separate but not equal, even though the law said they had to be, everything else was not equal.
Mm-hmm. You go to a restaurant and they tell you, oh, we'll serve you, but y'all got to go around to the back. Okay, my father was not doing that. Mm-hmm. That never happened. And then, and this is kind of interesting, after the ink was barely dry on the 1964 Civil Rights Act, when our family had moved to Cleveland, and my father wanted to test it. And so we had a family road trip from Cleveland, and we were going to drive down to Montgomery, see our relatives down there. And we went with another family who had grown up in Montgomery.
Right.
And we got down, it might have been Tennessee or somewhere around there. And they said, well, let's go. And, we went to some little outdoor, it might have been like a Dairy Queen. I don't know if it was a Dairy Queen. It was something like that where you just kind of go and get an ice cream cone or a hamburger. Right. So my dad said, you all stay in the car. And the other gentleman, Earl Williams, told his family same thing. The two men would go up and order food. And they got there and the woman said, I can serve y'all, but you got to go around to the back. Well, we peeled out of there. You could see the dust of smoke coming from behind the cars. My father's going. So, you know, the law had changed, but didn't get.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled on education being unsegregated, and it took a long time for some school systems to make that change.
And we're resegregated.
Right.
So.
Today. You write from your point of view many years later that, quote, you didn't understand why people of color put up with the slights, the insults, the humiliation. And to get a deeper understanding of that, you talked to your Uncle Fred. He, your father, others helped force this change. It took a long, long time. It's still going on. But what was it about that generation, that time, that suddenly these people were willing to do that, were able to do it when others who had come before in the 40s and the 30s and the 20s could not?
Fed up. They were just fed up, and they made connections with some of the right people. E.D. Nixon was the guy my Uncle Fred called Mr. Civil Rights in Montgomery. He was the president of the NAACP. He was head of a group called the, some kind of Democrats, Progressive Democrats, there you go. He was a Pullman porter, and he was working with A. Philip Randolph to set up the Pullman Porters Union, Sleeping Car Porters Union, which was the road to the middle class for a lot of black people. Mm-hmm. And so they were around people who were thinking, we deserve a better lot in life, and we're going to do it. So my uncle and my father were encouraged to become lawyers because E.D. Nixon said, it's going to take the power of law for us to make change in the South. He had his eye on, Nixon did, bus boycotts that happened in other cities in the South, like Mobile, Alabama, and Baton Rouge. They weren't that successful. They didn't last that long. But, you know, it gave them the impetus to do something. And there was the role of women. There were a lot of women who were actively involved in making change in Montgomery. The Women's Political Council, which was headed up by a woman named Joanne Robinson and also Mary Fair Burks, they were meeting with city officials and the officials from the City Lines bus company to try to get better treatment for black people on the buses. And they could probably get meetings easier than some of the black male, you know, groups that were. So my uncle got, you know, around people who were movers and shakers and motivators, and they were encouraged by those people in addition to being angry on their own.
We were talking about some of the vestiges of Jim Crow, the color-only water fountains not being able to be served in restaurants, having to go to the back to get your food where they did serve you. And, of course, there's the famous, I think it's the Green Book for black travelers, telling you where you could stay safely as you traveled through the country, because you couldn't stay in the hotels and whatever motels may have existed.
I never saw that book.
Right, really.
And we used to travel to Louisiana because my mother was from Shreveport, and every year we would go. But after Emmett Till was lynched, when we would leave, we'd leave early in the morning so that we would drive through Mississippi during the day so nothing bad would happen on our way. And we knew places to go. I just kind of word of mouth, I never saw the Green Book.
But you write about something in your book that I never knew about with regard to this bus situation in Montgomery. Everybody knows that when you get on a bus, at least back in the 50s, you got on the bus in the front door and you put your little dime in the little coin box, and the driver would, and it would drop into the bin and you go find your seat. Everybody did that. Black people had an extra step. Mm-hmm. I did not know about this. Talk about that.
It wasn't every time, but here was the deal. You'd get on the bus, you put your dime in.
Right.
But the first 10 seats on every city bus were reserved for white people. If they weren't sitting there, you still couldn't sit there. If the bus was crowded and white people were there, the bus driver didn't want you to walk past the white people because, you know, we were considered inferior. So you would have to get off the bus, go walk along the side of the bus and get in on the back and get in that way, which was kind of an outrage.
I never knew that.
And here's what would happen. A lot of times, you know, some of those bus drivers were mean. They hated black people anyway. And you'd get off the bus and they'd leave you. So you're stuck. You're like stuck at the bus stop. You're rushing to get to work. You're going to be late to work.
You've already paid your dime.
And you got to pay another dime to get on the other bus. I mean, this is why, you know, people, they remembered how Hilliard Brooks had been killed. Mm-hmm. So that was just the climate of the time that made people want to change or do something about it.
America has lost, just this year, several civil rights icons. One of your heroes, your personal heroes, the man that you credit with getting you into your career, Jesse Jackson, passed away this year. And the other was Claudette Colvin. Mm-hmm. She was 15 years old, I think, when 9 months before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, Claudette Colvin refused to give up her seat on that same Montgomery bus system. She was dragged off that bus by police, handcuffed, arrested at the age of 15. And you write about her going to jail and sobbing and reciting Bible verses because she was in such trouble. But it was Rosa Parks whose refusal sparked this movement. Why not Claudette Colvin?
Claudette was, I'll give you a little bit of background on just what happened that day. Claudette was a smart girl, honor student. You know, she was on the bus, and it was in March, March the 2nd, right after Black History Week. I think we didn't have a month then. And she had been learning all those things about how, you know, Black people were oppressed and, you know, about the leaders and this. And she felt like when the police came and knocked her books out of her lap and, you know, told her to get up, she felt like Sojourner Truth had one shoulder and was holding her down, and Harriet Tubman was holding the other one down.
Well,
and
so you're right that she told you when you interviewed her that history had glued her glued to the seat.
Great words. Great sentence.
Well, the reason there was no boycott was because Claudette got pregnant that summer. There was a move to try to get a boycott, but Black leaders did not want an unwed teenage mother to be the face of their fight against segregation. So, and she felt, I'll just add this thing, Rosa Parks stole her thunder.
Oh, she did feel
that
way.
She did feel that way. Mm-hmm.
It took you a long time to get to her, to interview her. She was 78 when you finally got to her. The memories were still vivid?
Mm-hmm. She gave me a lot of detail. She was, and I begged for that interview for years. She had been staying out of the spotlight. You know, she left Alabama because she couldn't get a job after what happened. You know, she got pregnant and people really didn't want to talk to her. And so she moved to New York and lived in the Bronx. And she stayed out of the spotlight, except she did cooperate with a guy who wrote a book about her, a children's book. And then after that, she shied away from the press. Well, I begged and begged and begged. I went through my uncle. She finally said yes.
I'm going to talk some more about her when we come back, and we'll talk about some about Rosa Parks as well, because she's the woman that inspired the movement ultimately, this bus boycott that changed everything. Our guest today is Karen Gray Houston. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Karen Gray Houston. Her book is called Daughter of the Boycott, Carrying on a Montgomery Family's Civil Rights Legacy. Her family is deeply intertwined in this movement, even though you may not know her father's name or her Uncle Fred's name. We'll talk about that when we go through this in a moment. But we were talking before the break about Claudette Colvin, who refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus months before Rosa Parks did. Rosa Parks is the one we all remember for not giving up her seat because she inspired the movement. Claudette Colvin, though, plays another role in all of this. She became one of the four plaintiffs in the federal case filed by your Uncle Fred that ultimately led to the end of segregation on buses. Your Uncle Fred, if I've done the math right, and correct me if I'm wrong, was 24 years old.
Young kid, just fell out of law school.
Yes, he just started practicing law. How is it possible for them to choose him to take this case to the United States Supreme Court?
Lucky him. There was one other Black lawyer in Montgomery, Charles Langford, and two of them eventually partnered up. But when he first got there, you know, Charles kind of felt like, well, he's a new kid on the block. Right place, right time, knows the right people, knows Joanne Robinson, knows E.D. Nixon, starts going to the NAACP meetings because he's, you know, he's on that mission. He's going to get this law degree and he's going to destroy everything segregated he could find. So he needs to drum up some business to find out how he can do this. So he goes to these NAACP meetings, and where E.D. Nixon is the president, Rosa Parks is the secretary. And she also heads up their youth council. So they meet, and they're kindred spirits, really. Rosa Parks was not that little tired lady on the bus that people did subdued, you know, whatever. She was an activist, and she had this hatred of segregation, just like my uncle. And they were talking about, what can we do? They started having meetings in his new law office, which was down the street and around the corner from the department store where she was working.
They had lunch every day, you're right.
They were having lunch and they were talking. Yeah. They were talking next steps. What are we going to do? And, you know, the Claudette thing had happened, and she was saying, well, if I'm ever in a situation where I can do something, here's how I should behave. She had had a bad experience with a bus driver before, the same bus driver on the bus when she was arrested, where he made her get off the bus and go around to the back, and she refused to get back on the bus. So she was at a point where she was going to seize an opportunity that presented itself, and it did.
Yeah. I wish I had read your book. I interviewed Rosa Parks a long time ago.
Oh, lucky.
And I thought of her exactly as you described her, this meek woman who just happened to be having a bad day that day, refused to give up her seat. And that's the way I treated her during the interview. If I had read your book, if I had known about this, it would have been a completely different conversation.
She was soft-spoken, but, you know, a steely kind of soft. And yeah. She was an investigator for the NAACP. They sent her down to Abbeville, Alabama, in 1947 to investigate the case of a woman named Recy Taylor who had been raped by six white men. Mm. You know, I mean, she was married to a civil rights activist. Raymond Parks was a guy who was involved with that case about the Scottsboro boys. They were,
right.
Yeah, so I don't know if you know that whole, you can look it up, case. But, you know, she was just proud to have met and married a man who was an actual activist.
I'm talking about Claudette Colvin for a moment, because you talked about how she was a little upset that Rosa Parks stole the spotlight. You spoke with her, and she had a bone even then to pick with the National Museum of African American mm-hmm, History and Culture mm-hmm. and their display, which depicts the Montgomery bus boycott. She told you, quote, "It's inaccurate and confusing. Change it. Get it right." Mm-hmm. "Because people coming from all over the world sees that. Mm-hmm. They should change it." Mm-hmm. What did she want changed, and did they change it?
I don't think so. You know, Rosa Parks gets, if you go down to the exhibit, and I did, big, there's a mannequin with a dress that Rosa Parks was working on the day that she was, you know, arrested. And there's a mention of Fred Gray, and there's some small exhibits about Martin Luther King. The way the exhibit works makes it look as if the person, you know, the mother of the boycott, mother of the civil rights movement, who was Rosa Parks, is the person who was the most important, had the most important role in that boycott. And basically, Claudette and those other plaintiffs that you mentioned in the federal case that went to the Supreme Court, that was what turned the tide in Montgomery. Not Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks, right. And I love Rosa Parks, and she was an important person. Her case was a case of disorderly conduct that was moving its way through the local courts. And my uncle, who represented Rosa Parks and Claudette, thought that if he wanted some change, it was going to have to come outside of Alabama. And so that's why he filed that federal case, you know, Browder v. Gale.
Right.
Aurelia Browder was one of the plaintiffs versus Gale, the mayor of the city at the time. And it went up to a federal court that said that, you know, segregated busing was unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court affirmed that ruling.
So your brother Fred, your uncle Fred, at a very young age, takes this case, which goes to the Supreme Court. He also, as you said, represents Rosa Parks. Your family's fingerprints are all over the civil rights movement. Your family was involved with those two people, Claudette Colvin, Rosa Parks. You have spoken with Rosa Parks many times. You spoke with Claudette Colvin in your father's retail business, which sold radio and television and other appliances. He sold a washing machine and two TV sets to Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta.
he bragged about that.
He sold the TV to Ralph Abernathy, another icon of the civil rights movement. Your family is intertwined with this. You're all a part of American history. So let me ask you a question that really aggravates me when he asks it on his TV show. Henry Louis Gates always asks on Finding Your Roots, how does that make you feel? So your family's all over this. How does that make you feel? You're part of American history.
I am so proud. That's why one of the reasons I had to write the book. This is a very personal story mm-hmm. for me. I wanted to salute my dad, Thomas Gray, and Uncle Teddy for what they did. I mean, what they did, and not just them, but, you know, these other unsung foot soldiers. They risked their lives, you know, put their lives on pause. There was that 382-day bus boycott so that, you know, it was this fight for some basic human, civil, social justice. And it resulted in, I benefited from that. I mean, look, you know, they opened doors of opportunity for me and countless other people.
Yes, they did.
So
Rosa Parks, as you said, is not the meek, being at the right place at the right time person that she is made out to be. And you say that her personal papers reveal a side to her that most people are only beginning to discover. And you print a quote from one of those papers in which Rosa Parks writes, "I would rather be lynched than live to be mistreated." Mm-hmm. She wrote that she felt oppressed by white supremacy and deprived of a proper education. If she kept that to herself but still had the courage to maintain her seat on the bus, how many others felt exactly the same way? What about your father? What about your mother? What about your uncle?
They didn't ride the buses.
Because
we had a car. You know, and my uncle got a car. My dad sold my uncle one of his. He was like, you know, here, take over the payments. So he had a car. So we were unaccustomed to riding the bus. But, you know, they felt the pain that other people were feeling. And they, you know, they saw it was outrageous the way we were being treated. It was just egregious. And so they wanted to do something about it.
And you mentioned that Fred, your uncle, had lunch with Rosa Parks almost every day. And they kind of talked about the situation. And it seems as though in some of these conversations that you write about, that the idea that she had to stay in that seat was not sown that day on that bus.
Huh.
It came out of a series of these conversations with your Uncle Fred.
They were talking about how a person should behave should one be asked to give up a seat. And they were looking at past experience. Look what happened with Claudette. I mean, you know, she was dragged off the bus kicking and screaming and, you know, clawing and scratching or whatever. She said she wasn't scratching, but she was accused of assault against a police officer. So, you know, Rosa Parks was a very genteel lady. Mm-hmm. And though she was angry about some things. And so they just thought that, you know, if we want to be successful, just, you know, sit in the seat quietly. If they tell you to get up, get up. No kicking, screaming, yelling. And that was the way the arrest happened.
I think the fine for that arrest was something like $10, $14, somewhere in that mm-hmm, neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You were four on the morning of that bus boycott. But you write about a conversation that your mother and father had in bed really early in the morning, like pre-5 a.m., because they couldn't sleep because they knew what was going to happen that day.
And they always got up early anyway.
And your father was going to be playing a key role mm-hmm. in this boycott. Where did that information come from? You were four, and there's dialogue of mm-hmm. what they said to each other. Where did that come from?
Well, a little of the dialogue I made up myself. Some I talked mm-hmm. to my father about. I wasn't able to get that at the time from my mother because she had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's mm-hmm. by then. But my dad said, you know, Mom had been watching television the night before, and the police commissioner, Clyde Sellers, had been telling people that the cops were going to be following these people who were driving the cars to pick up passengers so they wouldn't get on the buses, and that they were looking out because they were going to be these Negro goon squads trying to keep people off the buses, which was, nothing was true about that. But my mother told my father about it, and he said, no, we're not. And she was angry and upset. It was like, I don't want you going out there and putting yourself in a situation where the cops are going to do something to you.
Right.
So she was afraid.
Ultimately, he was arrested.
Yes.
All of them were arrested.
89 people who drove their cars, who were my uncle, the bus boycott lawyer, Martin Luther King, the spokesperson, Rosa Parks, she was arrested. 89 people were, there was a roundup and it lasted several days.
And part of that was due to the fact that your father, among other people, when the bus boycott was underway and people couldn't get to work and they couldn't get to school and they couldn't get to where they were going to go to get groceries or anything else, they would walk to avoid riding the bus. But your father and others had their personal vehicles, mm-hmm. and they would see somebody walking and they would pull over and say, do you need a ride? And they would get in and they would take them where they wanted to go.
It started out like that.
Yeah.
And then they devised just a very elaborate carpool system,
yeah.
where certain people went to certain, my dad went to a certain church every morning early and he would pick up people. You know, Martin Luther King actually picked up people. And was, you know, so one day my dad was driving. He had picked up some people at the church and was taking them to their jobs. And the police pulled him over and wanted to see his, you know, driver's license, registration. Looked in the car, was, you know, boy, why all those people were in there. Didn't say anything much more than that. But that's how they found out who was actively involved. And one day, mom sits at home and a sheriff's deputy comes, knocks on the door, says they're looking for Thomas Gray. They got a warrant for his arrest. He wasn't there, but he was in the neighborhood because they did they repaired radios and TVs as well as sold them. So he was out in the neighborhood working on somebody's radio or something.
Mm-hmm.
Came by the house and my mom was just frantic. Oh, the cops just left here. They're looking for you. And the sheriff's deputy drove back by, saw my dad's van, the work van. Stopped and said, we have a warrant, going to arrest you. And my dad said, well, I've got the van for my job. Can I take this car back to the shop before we go up to the jail? And the cop, the sheriff's deputy said, sure. And my dad was shocked that it was so civilized.
Yeah, and there were, you're right about a lot of people who were being arrested were being treated civilly, which mm-hmm. is an amazing thing. Well, I think there was a preacher who was involved and he was mm-hmm. involved in something and he wanted to finish that before he said, well, can I come down later when I'm done with this? And I said, sure, come on down. Turn yourself in. explain that to me, because we know about all these arrests that are violent and vile, and this was completely civilized.
I don't know where they got it. If that order came from Clyde Sellers, it's amazing to me because he's a white guy who had joined the White Citizens Council, which is kind of a racist group. But I guess they wanted to try to get all their ducks in a row, and they thought they were going to be successful in the prosecution of these people for violating some anti-boycott law. But it was like a big circus. You know, my dad finally got to the jail, and they were all Reverend Abernathy's out front with a bunch of people, and they go in, and they had a businessman who was bailing everybody out so nobody was behind bars. And they came out, and they all, like, wore that arrest like a badge of honor.
Mm. We only have a couple of seconds left here, but the world did not end when the black people were able to sit anywhere they wanted to on the buses. The world did not end when schools integrated. The world did not end when Barack Obama became the first black president of the United States. The world did not end when people like yourself were invited into newsrooms around the country to be reporters, not just on black news, but on all news. It didn't end. And yet there are forces at work today that would like to turn back the clock. Do you understand why?
Because racism is still embedded in the fabric of the country. You know, it gets passed down through generations. Some people turn their backs on it. You know, the daughter of that Clyde Sellers, the racist police commissioner, admitted to me that her father was a racist, and she was a rebel. She took some classes at Tuskegee Institute. At HBCU, she became a social worker. I don't understand it. I think there was a lot of progress for a while, and now here we are.
Yeah. One step forward, two steps back. Maybe two steps forward, one step back. Let's hope it's that way. The book is valuable. It's valuable because you'll learn things you never knew. It's valuable because it reminds you of a time that is not quite past. Daughter of the Boycott, Carrying on a Montgomery Family Civil Rights Legacy, by our guest today, Karen Gray Houston. It's about her father, her uncle, and a lot of other people that made a significant difference in the world. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you for having me.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.